This is David's Book Talk, bringing authors and book lovers together in a unique way since 2009. Visit us at davidsbooktalk.com and join the conversation at facebook.com/davidsbooktalk. But first, pull up a chair, relax, and enjoy today's episode. Here's your host, David English.
Hello, and welcome to David's Book Talk. Today we're going to talk to Robert Dugoni and his new book, In the Clearing, which has a very interesting cover. I love this cover. It's just out from Thomas and Mercer and is available on Kindle, right? This is a big Kindle book, too, right?
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's a big Kindle book, but you can get it in the paperback, and I know people that are asking stores to order for them, people who are still more inclined to open up and smell the pages and all that kind of stuff. It's done extremely well.
Yeah, I don't know how. I guess you can't get your Kindle signed, so I guess you have to get a book if you want to get it signed.
Actually, I do have people that come up and ask me to sign their Kindle, though. It's pretty ironic.
Really?
They have covers, and so they'll have people sign the covers, and they'll have a pen and a felt pen, and
oh, isn't that crazy?
I've seen some that are just remarkable. I mean, I've seen some that have the biggest names in the business on them. You know, I've seen ones that have, Lee Child and Stephen King and you name it. And there's just a ton of people that are up there. It's kind of fun to do it, and put it up there. Other people do it with things like programs or T-shirts or whatever. It's pretty funny.
I have to say, Bob, and then we talked, I think, for the Jury Master, which is so many... How many years ago was that, anyway?
Probably 11 or 12, yeah.
Has it been that many years?
It's been a long time.
I must say, you have grown so much as a writer, and when I first started the Tracy Crosswhite series, I saw the first book, and I thought, oh, maybe this is going to be good, maybe I won't like it, what do I do? And I just... absolutely fell in love with the series right away. And it's hard. It's like eating one peanut when you first start the book. It's just amazing how well it's written. And I always think about that when I first pick up a book. I hope it's written well. If it's not written well, I know it's going to be hard to get through it. But your books are amazing.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And I do like to believe I've grown as a writer. I mean, I'm 10 or 11 books out now. And you hope that over the course of writing a book, you really have discovered your voice and you've discovered your audience. And, I think for me, that's very true. You know what buttons to push and how to push them. And I think then you just become more comfortable writing honestly, which, Stephen King says is the most important thing, is writing honestly.
Absolutely.
And I think when you write honestly, it impacts people. At the same time, I tell readers all the time, my books are fairly clean. I don't have a lot of swearing in my books anymore. I don't have a lot of sex scenes, if any at all. I'm usually cut, fade to black. And a lot of that is just sort of discovering, what you need and what you really don't need in a book. Getting the book to just continually move forward to that epic moment that you've envisioned as a writer. So I appreciate the compliment. I've worked hard at trying to get better, and I do think I'm better than I was when I first started.
Well, I don't give compliments like that out very, very easily, because I have found a lot of series have become dull over the years, and some of them anyway. I won't name any names, but to me, they just are not the same. But, I mean, every book in this series has been fantastic. There has not been a bad one yet. Don't let that jinx you or anything.
It's hard. You and I were talking a little bit. I have the fourth coming out in February of 2017, it's a good book. I mean, it's a good book. I think people are going to like it along the lines of My Sister's Grave and Her Final Breath and In the Clearing, and they're going to go, wow, here's another one. It's an emotional book. It's a complicated book. There's twists and turns. But at the same time, I'm sitting here today, trying to come up with that next idea, and I think I have that next idea, but you're never sure when you're getting started that next idea is going to have rival the same impact that your prior books have had. So I really commend people that are able to continue and extend a series. Writers are like everybody else, you know. We're gonna, it's like guys that paint, you know. I mean, you find one painting and it just really moves you, and you go to the fourth painting that the person painted and you kind of go, well, yeah, that's okay. You know, it's hard. It's a difficult thing to do, to constantly, try to, bring out emotion in people and all those kind of things. So,
Why did you start a new series? I mean, what you were doing, David Sloan. You did five books with David Sloan.
Yeah.
So what made you stop and start this series?
Necessity. I was with a publisher, and the conviction came out, and they did nothing to promote it. They did nothing to promote me. They just kind of put the book out there, and I'm a genre fiction writer, which means I rely very heavily on paperbacks. And Barnes & Noble was fighting with Simon & Schuster, and so Barnes & Noble basically told Simon & Schuster that they wouldn't carry any Simon & Schuster authors except some of the really big names like Stephen King. And so we got a phone call one afternoon saying, we're not going to put the book out in paperback, so here's your money. Well, that's the kiss of death. I mean, to expect that people who read my genre, who read mysteries and thrillers, are going to go pay $25 for a hardcover, it's just not tenable. So sort of a long story is the book didn't do well when it came out. There's some people at Simon & Schuster who I really respect who were very honest with me and came forward and told me that. But, because of that, we knew that the next David Sloan book would probably not get picked up by anybody because they'd look at the numbers and they'd say, oh, this is a dying series. So my agent really had the thought that, you need to come up with something new, something different. And I had a very obscure character in Murder One, which is a David Sloan novel, and that obscure character was Tracy Crosslight. She was a Seattle homicide detective, but at one point had been a high school chemistry teacher whose nickname was the Professor. And I called my agent and I said, this character seems really interesting to me. And she said, well, why was she a high school chemistry professor? And I said, I have no idea. I don't know why I did that, but I'll get back to you. And so I started exploring her as a character, and then I started also reading the newspapers, and it was right around the time they were taking down the dams here in Washington State to restore the natural habitat of the wild salmon. And I read that when they take the dams down, the reservoir of water that it accumulates up above to feed the dam shrinks back to its original river size, which means you lose a lake. And I thought to myself, well, what if, somebody found a body when that lake was drained? And that's where the idea came from. It was Tracy's sister, and she's going home to find out what happened. And, I think beyond that, I have four sisters, and I grew up in a house with four sisters and five brothers, but I did have, four sisters, and I worked in the legal profession with a lot of very strong and competent women. And then I had some really good homicide detectives that were willing to help me. And I tried to create a character who has a huge wound in her heart and how she deals with that going forward in her life. I did not try to write from the perspective of a woman. I thought that would be a recipe for disaster. I tried to write from the perspective of a human being that has suffered a grievous loss and is trying to move on with her life but can't.
And her life itself is kind of a mess too. She can't relate. Her relationships are very choppy and unpredictable, and she can't seem to keep a date.
she can't, the reason is because she can't allow herself to be happy because she feels responsible for her daughter, her sister's death at 22 years of age or 18 years of age. Her sister has died and disappeared, and she feels responsible for that. And you can imagine that. The tremendous guilt that a young person would feel about that. And so, every time she tries to be happy, she thinks of her sister who will never be happy. And it's a horrible thing. And I talk with people that have lost, spouses or lost siblings. And, I don't think it's something that you ever you ever truly recover from. You know, we were talking a little bit off the air. You know, my heart pours out to those poor people in Orlando, Florida, who, you know, the victims of just a horrible massacre. And, you know, the thing that I think people need to realize that the homicide detectives told me is, you know, those people that died, it's tragic. It's really tragic. But what's even more tragic is the people that are going to have to move on and try to move forward without those human beings in their lives. You know, spouses, sons, you know, they're not going to be there anymore. And every time you sit down at Christmas, at Easter, at, you know, Thanksgiving, whatever the event is, a wedding, you know, a birth of a child, there's going to be a hole in those people's families, and they're going to feel it every single time that happens.
It's hard to even...
That's really what...
Yeah, it's hard to...
That's really what I tried to capture with Tracy Crosslight.
It's hard to even imagine that horror, and I think about that every time I hear about it. That's why it's hard for me to watch the news, because there's a lot of stuff like that. And I think, you know, I just, my heart just goes out to everybody. I mean, you think of 50 people being dead, it's just hard to even comprehend that many. When they first said it was 5, and then all of a sudden it was 50, and it's like, your heart stops. You're like, oh my, you know, how can it be that many people? How can there be that much hate in this world?
I think the trap that we all get into is we think about 50 people, so it becomes sort of faceless and nameless. What I think I tried to do in my sister's grave is get people to think about that one person. You know, think about that one person in 50, and just what impact that one person in 50 has on the people that are left behind, on their family, on their small town, on all of that. And you know, then you go and you magnify it. But you know, I think it's a mistake for the media and everyone else to put it out there as a big number. Oh, 50 people are dead. It's the worst massacre in U.S. history. That's not really what it's about. That's not really what's important. It's important that it was the worst massacre. In fact, I wish they'd stop advertising that. It's really about the individual lives that have been cut short for no reason.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, it's a tough world out there in publishing, because you have a lot of, you're competing with so many different authors for, but you're really good at what you do. I mean, you're not the average. I mean, you go to a store and you see a paperback and you pick it up and you say, oh, this sounds interesting, but you don't know how the author writes, and it's all going to be dependent on how that author writes. But you write well. I mean, you really write well, and I've not had a book of yours that I've read that I haven't enjoyed, and that's saying a lot, because there's a lot out there that's mediocre.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Thank you. You know, I think I take it seriously. I take my commitment to the reader seriously. I cannot expect that a reader will pick up the first book in my series. I've had people pick up In the Clarion and read it and say, oh my God, this book was really incredible. I'm going to go read your other two. Well, In the Clarion had been terrible, or just not very appealing, they would never go back and buy the first two books in the Tracy Crosslight series. So I think authors have an obligation to their readers. Really, you know, it's not about book contracts. It's about the contract that you make with a reader. When that reader goes online and spends, you know, $7.99 for your book, or whatever the price, $10.99 for your book. I mean, that's a contract that you're making with those people, that they're spending their money wisely, and it's going to be a good investment.
I think everybody should go out and get all of them, because you're going to enjoy every one of these books, and you have my word on that.
No, thanks.
I say that, but I really mean it, and I don't say that to a lot of authors, and you know, usually the authors I interview I like anyway, but you know, there have been some authors that I haven't liked, and you know, and it's so hard when you first get into a book, you have to be able to get into the characters, to really, and this In the Clearing, I mean, the more you get into it, the more interesting it gets, and it's just, you know, it's to the point of, well, I don't know what time I have to go to work, I think I'd rather stay home and read this book, you know, and you really get into that trap where late at night you don't want to go to sleep and you're reading the book, and it's just that great. This book is really that good. And
well, I got a lot of help from the homicide people that I speak to, and the trackers who go out there and do it, and I think that's the stuff that's really interesting, that people really enjoy reading about, is, you know, how do police put this stuff together sometimes, and And the tracker, she calls herself, she's a man tracker. You know, she's a person that can go and look at the ground and kind of see and find out what happened. And you know, when I went to talk with her and consult with her, and I told her that this was a 40-year-old, you know, mystery of a woman who disappeared, she said, "Are they photographs?" You know, because otherwise she wouldn't have been able to help me. But I said, "If they're photographs, you know, she's that good. She can look at photographs and see what happened, et cetera, et cetera." And that kind of stuff I think is really fascinating, which is why the general public is so enthralled by police procedurals and police books and movies and television series that are all out there. So I felt very blessed to have a lot of help.
Now, how old is Tracy Cross? How old is Tracy at the beginning of the series?
Early 40s. She's like 41 or so, 40, 41.
And each book, now how old is she in The Clearing? Is she about the same?
I just went through the edits for the fourth book, and I think she's 43 in the fourth book. So she does age as you go through the series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny. We don't really notice her age at first. I mean, we don't think about it while we're reading the books. I think I'm just enjoying the book so much that I don't even think about her age.
Well, yeah, and I mean, hopefully that will always be the case. And because if I'm writing the 18th Tracy Crosswhite book, you know, someday people will be saying, "Well, wait a minute, isn't she 60 now?" And you know, that's the difficult part of another difficult part of a series. You know, we all can't write James Bond. You know, James Bond is always forever young and forever talented and forever good looking and forever, you know. But for the rest of us, we all get old. You know. We get old and we get back injuries and our knees hurt and you have to have hips replaced and you know what I mean? There's all those things. And so I'm trying to make her very real. The fourth book is, you know, she's facing some very real things that, you know, people her age, you know, you begin to face, you know, the ticking clock about having a family or not having a family, getting married, not getting married. And, you know, all those questions, you know, sort of come into play. So
the question is, is it harder to face the readers or the judge in the courtroom? I mean, which is more difficult for you?
The judge tells you, you know, tells you to your face, and there's usually not a very big audience in a courtroom. You know, readers get on Amazon or Goodreads and post their reviews, and you know, you get some nasty ones, and I just attribute that, you know, to there are people out there that are not going to like the book, and that's fine. But you're also going to have people out there that, for whatever reason, just, you know, they just dislike things to dislike things, and you know, those are the ones you just kind of got to discount. And you know, it begins to roll. I mean, I get so many reviews now, which is a wonderful thing. You know, I think My Sister's Grave has over 10,000 reviews now.
Is it really?
Yeah, and it's just, you know, it's not possible to read all of them. It's just not. And I certainly, if I do pull up, you know, the book to see how many are selling or whatever, I'm certainly not going to spend a lot of time reading the ones that say I hated it. Which are, you know, they're not a lot of them, but every once in a while you'll see it. I mean, I think it's like 4.5 out of 5. So I'm really thrilled that there are so many people out there that enjoy the book, and I just can't focus on the ones that don't, because you know you never know what you're getting or why you're getting.
Well, yeah, like you said, there's always going to be the you can't get away from that. Even Stephen King has haters, you know.
Yeah, I mean I always go back and I say, if you pull up The Kill a Mockingbird, you will find that there are a number of people that gave it a 1-star review. Well, did they really not like the book? That's fine. Or were they racist? Were they have a bad day? Did their dog die? You know what I mean? So many things that can be attributed to it that you kind of just have to. It's part of being a writer. It's part of being in the public eye, and you accept it and move on.
What's tough for me is when I do these interviews, I have to be careful not to give away too much. Now, what we were talking about before we went on the air is something I can't even mention, and I almost thought of it, and I thought, I stopped myself, and I thought, oh, God, I can't even say that. You know, you got to be so careful that you don't give away any part of the book. And I've had people say, don't tell me you're going to spoil it for me. And there's a lot of fear of that, of people, you know, and giving away plots can really cause a lot of trouble.
Yeah, and you know, and I think for the most part, people that post reviews on Amazon and Goodreads and stuff, they honor that, which I think is a really nice thing. I mean, they really do. They honor that whole thing. Because you're right. I mean, that's the fun of mysteries and thrillers, is you're sitting there trying to say, I figured it out. And the trick for authors is to let the reader think they've figured it out, but then have one more twist or one more thing that just makes it difficult. My dad was a great fan of mysteries and thrillers on TV, and he would you know, watch a movie, and you know, we'd all as kids be in the room watching it with him, and he'd look at you and he'd say, "Didn't figure it, you know what it is? It figured it out. It figured it out." You know, a lot of times he was right, but sometimes he was wrong, and that was always the really fun movies, because then we could all, you know, needle him and give him a bad time. Of course, we didn't figure it out either. But that I think there's an inherent funness, if you will, that kind of rests in a lot of these books is you know, people kind of matching wits with the character to see if they can figure out who it is. I read a lot. I'm reading a book now, and it's, you know, I don't know where it's going or how it's going to get there. And that's kind of the fun part of it is those twists and turns that take us in different directions.
Well, what's the who's the author?
It's for a blurb, so I can't really say yet.
Okay.
But it's an interesting book. He's a Scottish writer. It's about a Scottish detective.
I have an idea who it is. I could be wrong, though.
And, you know, he's very big over there, and he's just trying to get his feet wet over here. But he writes really well, and like I said, there's already been a couple of twists and turns, and so yeah, that's what makes books fun.
Well, writing your books, I mean, I wonder if you lose sleep over some of these books, writing them.
What do you mean? What do you mean?
Trying to think of how the book's going to go, or how you're going to finish it, or how.
There's always anxiety. I mean, that's kind of like I said. I think that's what Stephen King meant, is, you know, the biggest anxiety is when you start a new project. But
why does he make it look so easy, though, Stephen King? Why does he makes everything look so simple?
Yeah, he does. And I don't know if he outlines or doesn't outline. I don't think he outlines.
I doubt he does.
I don't outline either. I really don't. I kind of will have an idea. Like the fourth book I just wrote, I didn't know who the killer was until I wrote it. And that, for a writer, that's kind of the fun of it, but it's also what causes the fear.
I mean, do you wake up with an idea sometimes?
Oh yeah. And you know, I've gone to my writing desk here in my home, and at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'm going. But I think really you just have to, you know, you have to say to yourself, you know, I've written 12 books. It always works out. You know, this one will work out too. It'll get there, you know, and you just can't fear the unknown. And that's hard for me, because that is something that is, you know, problematic for me, troublesome for me, is, you know, that the fear of what's going to happen next in terms of what your life, or in terms of your kid's life, you know. And so when you do that on a daily basis, you know, you have to trust your ability to work your way through it.
Mm-hmm.
You have to trust your ability that you've done it before, and you'll do it again, and it's going to happen, and you just keep going forward.
Now, you've been on the bestseller list for Amazon for these books?
Yeah, so the Tracy Crosswhite book was the number one book on Amazon for months. I mean, it just did phenomenally well, and it's been number one in 5 countries. It was number one in Germany, in France, in Italy. Germany, France, Italy, the UK, and Australia. It's been recently released in Spain.
That's amazing.
And so it's done really well. In fact, it was on the New York Times bestseller list until they found out that I was working for Thomas Mercer, and then they went back and retroactively took me off the New York Times bestseller list, which is kind of a funny story in and of itself. And then the Wall Street Journal, when the Clarion came out, it actually became the number two book on the Wall Street Journal. I think for 2 weeks.
You're really doing well, Bob.
Yeah, I'm thrilled. I have found a publisher at Thomas & Mercer who truly believes in what I do, who worked hard to promote me, who doesn't promote me for just 3 weeks and then say good luck. They promote me constantly. They've promoted My Sister's Grave for more than 2 years, and the book continues to sell phenomenally. well, you know, was just, again, it was back up to number 30.
Now, do they tell you how many units you sell? I mean, do they actually give you figures?
I know how many units I've sold. Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm with my sister's grave, I'm close to a million copies.
Really?
And you know, her final breath and in the clearing was just got started. We're in the 100,000s. So they do a phenomenal job for me. I mean I write as good a book as I possibly can. And then they, you know, they really get out there and they promote it and they do everything that they do to get it in people's hands. And I think the other thing that really helps is, you know, they're not always trying to sell it at, you know, on Kindle at $5.99 or paperback at $7.99. There's constantly deals and things that they do to promote it and get it out into people's hands. And then those people like it, and they tell other people, and they tell other people, and they tell other people, and it just kind of keeps spiraling that way. I get so many emails from people that say, "I had never heard of you. Yeah, I had never heard of you. I mean, where were you? What the hell is this?"
Exactly.
Really, it's about promotion. It's about you know, getting your name out there, and you know, it can be scary for a lot of writers. You know, people like, you know, Thomas Mercer came up to me with my sister's grave, and they said, "We want to make it a Kindle daily deal, which means that, you know, any Prime member for the first month can download it for free." And you know, you sit there and you think to yourself, "Oh boy," you know. But they have a plan. They had a plan in place, and you know, when that book came out, you know, it just got picked up like crazy, and the people that then read it, you know, started talking about it, and once people started talking about it, then people started buying it, and that's really as an author, as an artist, that's really what you want. You want people to read your books. You want people to look at your paintings. You want people to go to your studio. You know, you want people to acknowledge what you do, and the only way to do that is if you have somebody that's really, you know, out there on a daily basis, pushing it, and they have been a phenomenal promoter of my work.
And what's interesting about a series is sometimes you fall in love with the character in a series, but the way the books are written aren't necessarily that great. But these books are written really well. I mean, you can tell that you know what you're doing, and you're good at what you're doing. And when I was reading In the Clearing, all I could think of was, wow, wow. And then when it ended, I felt kind of like, what am I going to do now? There's nothing else to read. I've read them all. And you get that empty feeling of, I want another one so badly.
Yeah, well, thank you. I mean, you know, that's kind of what you go for. I mean, the same thing can be said about really good movies. You know, you watch a really good movie, and when it's over, you're still thinking about it. You're still wondering. And that's kind of what I've always tried to do is get, you know, you get people to wonder is, well, is she going to get married? Is she going to have kids? Is she going to find the killer? Is, you know, you want them to always have, what's going to happen to this person next? And those are really the kindest emails that I get is from people that see her, view her, Tracy Crosslight, almost like she's a real person and want to make sure she's going to be okay.
Well, she is a real person to you. She's a real person to me.
Yeah. No, and she is. I mean, she's definitely somebody that, you know, there's this weird world that we authors live in and create, that things become very, very real to us. Our characters become very real to us, and they talk to us. And we always tell people that the best books written are not the books that are thought through in the brain. The best books written come from the heart. And we become almost a medium, if you will, that just, we're just getting them out there, you know, into the public domain so that more and more people can read.
If you have that much of a heart, you must be a great dad.
You know, I have my moments, but, you know, I think like all dads, you know, I have better moments than others, and I learned on the job, as we all do. You know, my oldest son, I've always told him, I'll say to him, "Joe, never been a dad before, so I'm going to make mistakes, and unfortunately, most of my mistakes are going to be the mistakes I make with you." You know, you just, like I said, you try to do your best. Diana Gabaldon told me years ago, told the conference years ago, that, you know, she goes into her office and she closes the door and she lights a candle and she just waits till the characters start to talk to her. And I thought that was a bunch of mumbo jumbo, but, you know, over the years as I've done this more and more, I realized that she's exactly right. And that's really what we do. And there are going to be days where the characters don't talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
And those days do happen. And you gotta have confidence that, okay, well, I'm gonna do something else then. I'm gonna play around with the plot, or I'm gonna look at different things, or you just find ways to make it work.
This is going to sound so weird, but I'm looking forward to Tracy causing more trouble. She's a little bit of a troublemaker, but I like the fact that she causes trouble.
Well, she doesn't accept things. She doesn't just accept things. So she has a kind of a strained relationship with her captain for a lot of reasons. The short stories out there, the Academy, and all those sort of explain why she has a strained relationship with her captain. She's a person that she understands the pain and suffering that a family goes through when they lose somebody, when they lose a member of their family, and so it's a lot harder for her to just let things go. I've always said, being a police officer must be so difficult to think, because when you leave the office and you go to your son's Little League game, how do you get all those images and things out of your mind?
Exactly.
How do you get that evil out of your mind? It's harder for her to do that. It's harder for her to get it out of her mind because she's experienced both sides of the coin. She's been the person looking for the killer, and she's been the person who was a victim of the killer when she lost her sister.
Exactly. My heart goes out to Dan so much with these books. Poor Dan. It's left behind.
Yeah, he's a good guy, though. Dan is, her boyfriend, and he's a good guy. He's one of those guys that you kind of root for because he wants what's best for her. But he does. He also, he worries about her, and he becomes, he becomes a more prominent figure. He's very prominent in the first two books, but he becomes a more prominent figure again in the fourth book, just simply because, he's somebody that worries about her.
Are you liking this series more than the David Sloan series?
It's hard to say. It really is. I really liked David Sloan, and I had some really great characters that I really loved writing in the David Sloan series. So it's hard to say. People ask me all the time, please go back to David Sloan, and it's not that simple. There's business factors that are involved with, publishers,
right,
et cetera.
Right.
The Tracy Crosswhite series is doing so well. And so, you build this world, and then you attempt to make this world come to life. And she has a lot of great characters in her world. The team she works with Delmo Castigliano and Faz and Kensington Rowe, her partner, and then you got Johnny in Alaska, who's this captain that she just can't stand. And then you have the medical personnel, and you have all these different people that are out there in her world. That it becomes fun. The last book that I wrote, the fourth book that'll be out, called The Trapped Girl. Faz and Del play a bigger role in that book. And you begin to realize and come to realize, okay, who are these two guys, and how did they get to be cops? And they're not just, two Italian Goombas. They're actually, very, very competent at what they do. And so you begin to bring them out a little more. I have ideas about bringing out Kensington Rowe a little more. So these people start to come alive, and you start to ask yourself as a writer, kind of, who are they?
Well,
how do they get here?
Who do you bounce these things off of? I mean, when you come up with these ideas, how do you know they're going to work? Do you have like a test audience? Do you have like a test bunch of people that read it and say, oh, that works or that doesn't work? I guess
I'll bounce it first off my agent. I'll say, I'm thinking of a book in which such and such happens. And, I'm thinking it kind of go this direction, and this is kind of how I see it. And they'll listen to me, and they'll say, this all sounds really good, but, I don't think I would do this. I don't think I would do that. And then my editor, of course, Gracie Doyle is really good. It used to be Alan Turkis, but now it's Gracie Doyle, and both of them were really good at having, me say to them, okay, this is what I'm thinking. And, Gracie and I actually went to lunch one day, and I just started running ideas by her, and what could possibly happen and how they would go, and she gave me ideas and thoughts and, all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then you kind of reach a point where you got to sit down and write it. The funny thing is there are times where I say, okay, this is how I see the book, and this is what I'm going to do. And then you know, then you get back and you go, wait a minute, that's not the book I'm going to write. This is a better book, and you go in a kind of different direction. And, you know, I just keep them posted. I just keep them apprised of it.
Well, which one of the of them has been the hardest to write for you?
I would probably say the last one I wrote was the most difficult. My Sister's Grave started out, you know, sort of very grandiose, but I quickly pared it down to a personal story. Her Final Breath actually was something that came out of My Sister's Grave. It was the subplot in My Sister's Grave. I pulled it at the instruction of my editor, and we created a second book out of a subplot. So that one wasn't difficult. And then In the Clearing just kind of came to me, and it just kind of developed. And I'm a sports guy, and so a lot of that stuff just was there, and I just kind of pulled it all together. This last book was more difficult, and it was more difficult for a good reason, because I didn't know where it was going. I wasn't 100% sure where it was going. I didn't know exactly who the killer was going to be. I also started at a different place. I started with the thought that, you know, the murder was going to take place on Mount Rainier. And I went and I spoke to four or five people that had climbed Rainier and were experts on Rainier. And then when every single one of them said to me, now, why is your cop on the mountain? And I didn't have a good answer for him. I had to kind of go in a different direction, and you know, that takes time.
Interesting.
So I mean, I think that's difficult. I've been meeting with a JAG officer and talking with her and going through a bunch of stuff, and I have a meeting tomorrow night with my two homicide detectives for this new idea. And I just kind of go and I talk to them. I say, this is what I'm thinking about doing, and blah blah blah. And you know, they're really very helpful. And in The Trapped Girl, you know, Kensington Rowe, the character that I kind of liken him to, I was out talking to the detective, and he looked at me and he said, have you ever thought of a body in a crab pot? And I was like, huh? Yeah. He goes, yeah, you ever thought of she finds a body in a crab, they find a body in a crab pot? And that was sort of the genesis of The Trapped Girl.
Isn't that weird how one comment can make you change your whole way?
Well, it's chilling, isn't it? I mean, isn't it chilling to think of that? You know, that someone would kill somebody and stuff them in a crock pot?
Exactly.
Like, it's chilling. And I think that's the thing about it, is you think about the opening of your book and what you want for the opening of your book. And, you know, you want something that's going to grip people, hook people. And it is. It's very chilling.
Now, I obviously haven't read The Trap Girl yet. I wish I had now. It sounds wonderful. But everything so far in the series has been great and really terrific. How do you keep that up to par? How do you keep the good quality writing going? Aren't there days where you get up and you just don't feel like writing?
Yeah. I mean, I'm in those days right now.
Really?
I mean, I have a book that came out. I have a standalone that I literally wrote 10 years ago, and then went back and at the editor's request, and I reworked it and kind of reworked it, and that'll be out next. That'll be out in September.
Yeah, I saw
and
that.
Then I,
that looks
yeah,
interesting.
And then I, yeah, it's going to be a complete standalone. It's called The Seventh Cannon. I'm very excited about it. And then because I finished The Trapped Girl early, it's going to be out in February, and so my son's home from college, and you know, we don't get to see him that often, and we're going on a big family trip this week, leaving Thursday, and you know, I'm just trying not to do too much. I'm just trying to, you know, enjoy having him home, having my daughter home, and in the interim, I'm talking to people and I'm thinking of ideas, and like I said, you know, I won't probably start writing for a couple of weeks at least, but more just exploring the story. But you know, to get back to answering, you know, your question, you know, again, what I try to do is I try to find something that's an emotional tug, something that's an emotional appeal to people, that's out there, and I just kind of keep pulling on it, and you know, hopefully there, when people are done with the book, there's an emotional rise that I've gotten out of them.
You make it look easy. I mean, just from the books that I've read of yours, they're really that good. And I think, well, how does he do it? how do you sit, come up with things that are so interesting? And I mean, In the Clearing, just reading it, I mean, it's such a smoothly written book. I mean, it's one of those books you just, like I said, you the more you read it, the more interesting it gets, and it's a fact, it does. Because I've had people say to me, "Well, I get 30 pages into a book and I don't like it," you know, and
yeah,
so you got to grab the reader right away.
Yeah, I've never had that happen. I mean, I've heard it, but I've never had it happen. You know, I appreciate the compliment. I mean, it's not easy. It's something that, you know, we all work very hard at. I think the thing that I do, to be quite honest, is I just have to say to myself, what would she do next? What would she do next? What would she do next? And I will write a book that a lot of times will be really long. And I don't really worry about that on my first draft. I just keep saying, what would she do next? And what would she do next? And then I go back and I begin to cut it and pare it down. And, you know, people don't really care that, you know, she took a shower that morning. You know what I mean? So, okay, that can get cut. People didn't really, you know, there are scenes then that you begin to realize are not moving the story forward. They're not revealing any character and you don't need them. You can get rid of them. My daughter actually had kind of a very profound moment for me as an artist when, you know, several years back we went and we watched the Superman movie that came out. And there was a point in time in the Superman movie where the bad guy was flying to him and they'd fly into a building and they crash through the building and they come out the other side. Then he'd fly into a guy and they crash into a building, they go through a building and they come out the other side. Then they, you know what I mean? And,
yeah.
And finally, after about, you know, 15 minutes of this, my daughter, who was, you know, younger at the time, says, okay, we get it. He can fly through a building. Move on. Mm-hmm. And that's really what you do as a writer. You know, readers don't want to be bogged down seeing or hearing the same thing over and over and over. Oh, she's a really good shot. Oh, she's a really good shot. You know what I mean? Oh, she's sad. Her sister's dead. Her sister's dead. You know what I mean? They get it. They get it that first time. So, you know, there's a lot of just move on. You know, move forward. And for me, that's kind of what I have to be careful of, is not beating a dead horse. You know, realizing that you have intelligent people in readers. And they don't need to have Superman fly through a building 75 times to go, oh, okay, he can fly through a building. And so, you know, that was a very poignant moment for me with my daughter is, you know, say it once, show it once, and move on. You know, get on with it.
Now, are all these books carried by Barnes & Noble in their stores? Are they in paperbacks?
I've never had a problem with that. They're not necessarily in the store. Some of them keep them in the store. Some for readers have to go in and say, you know, I'd like to get In the Clearing by Robert Tagoni. And, you know, they'll say to them, we can get that for you. So I've never had a problem with that.
Interesting. I mean, if I worked at the Barnes & Noble, I'd have them where my picks are, you know, because it's something you want everybody to read. I really want everybody to enjoy this series like I enjoy it. The enjoyment I get out of it, you know, that somebody else could get that same enjoyment would really be cool.
Yeah, and I think that's what makes books sell is exactly what you just said. You know, it's me going to somebody and saying, have you read The Boys in the Boat? Have you read, you know, this book? Have you read, you know, the I'm drawing a blank now, but it's the one where Roosevelt goes down the Amazon, The River of Doubt.
You know, yeah.
And that's what gets people, you know, that's what sells books, is other people saying to, you know, to someone, you got to read this book.
Well, I feel, and I'm probably going to get criticized for this, I feel like you are a much better writer than James Patterson is. And he's probably going to hate me for saying that, but I really feel that you are. And
I think we write differently. I mean, I think James Patterson, I've never met him. I haven't met him, but I know him. I think he has a different philosophy. And I think his philosophy is that a book should just move from page one to page 300, and it should just move forward. And you know,
but there is a certain appeal to that, and I do enjoy reading some of his books, but I do get very, very upset when I don't like the ending of his books, and that happens sometimes.
I think it's like an episode of 24. You remember the TV show with Kiefer Sutherland?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It was always moving forward, and there was always action, and there wasn't, you know, wasn't a lot of time on character development or backstory or flashbacks. It just, you know, it was moving forward, and then before you know it, you're at the end. And you know, that's you know, obviously he's had tremendous success, and that's his belief. And there's obviously a lot of people that enjoy those kind of books. So I think we write differently. I had somebody read My Sister's Grave and say that you wrote you're a literary genre writer. It's a literary mystery. Well, I've never ever promoted myself as a literary writer.
Right.
I mean, there are people out there that have far better vocabularies and all that stuff. You know, that's not me. But I think people probably say that or said that because it is a little bit different than the, you know, the James Patterson Open Page One and Race to the Finish Line type of novel.
And that has a certain appeal. And you know, I'll be the first to tell you, there are some of his books I really, really have enjoyed. But I'm to the point where I insist on a good ending. If I don't get a good ending, I want to throw the book across the room. And that's how I feel. And that's not going to change because that's important to me. Every one of your books has had a great ending. And that it's not easy to do in any.
No.
It's easy to go for the same plots for certain people, you know, and they don't have good endings, or they don't have, you don't care about the characters, or the characters don't seem real enough. I mean, when your name becomes a household name and you're a writer, you can do whatever you want, and your books are still going to sell.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's true, but I go back to that.
But when I see your name on a book, Bob, that's, I expect a good book. I expect a good beginning, middle, and ending.
And I think you have a right to. And I think every reader that puts down their money to buy that book has a right to. I get a lot of emails from individuals that will say to me, "I'm recovering from cancer. I'm housebound. I don't have, you know, a lot of money to spend on books." And, you know, I just picked up a copy of your book. You know what I mean? I mean, that's a person that is truly invested hard-earned money in something that you've put out there and represented to them that you're going to like this. Now, you can't always have someone enjoy your book, but I think at the very least, you have an obligation to put a book out there that, you know, you feel strongly about, that when people buy it, they're not going to feel like they got ripped off.
Well, I'm sure when you said one of your books was, they put it out there on Amazon for people could get it for free. But I'm sure that after they read that, you had a huge surge in the next book. You had to have.
Oh, I had a huge surge in that book. I mean, that was My Sister's Grave.
Yeah.
And I don't know how many, I think we sold 150,000, we gave away 150,000 copies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's a scary moment for any writer. But then suddenly, reviews started coming in by the hundreds, not by the tens, but by the hundreds. And, you know, before I knew it, I was at 4,000 reviews. Well, you know, those are people that are talking and telling other people, you got to go get this book. And just like, you know, what happens with any good book. And, you know, then 800,000 later, more books are sold and those are bought. And, and so, again, I think it goes back to that you make a commitment to the reader and the reader will sell your book.
Now, what do they pay on Amazon? What do they pay in the stores for your book?
Well, I think it depends. I think on Amazon, my books are generally between $4.99 and $5.99 if you download it onto a Kindle.
Which is reasonable. Which is a very reasonable price.
Exactly.
Oh yeah.
Exactly. And you know, I know a lot of publishers have their beef with that, and you know, I understand the rationale behind it. I think if you want to buy them, download them, or if you want to buy an actual book, I think they're in the $10 to $11 range. And I think, you know, I think that's competitive with, you know, pricing that you'll find out there for paperbacks, that are out there in other stores. But, you know, there are a lot of people out there that won't buy the book even at $4.99 or $5.99 because they just can't.
Oh, I see here on the back.
Maybe 10 books a week, you know.
Yeah.
And they just can't. That's what I mean. There are a lot of people out there that they read a lot of books. They'll read 5-6 books a week. And because they're housebound, because they don't have an income, they're retired, you know, all those things. And I think that this is, you know, this is an opportunity for those individuals, you know, to read your book.
Absolutely. Now, is there going to be a beginning, middle, and ending to the Tracy Crossway series? Do you know how it's all going to end?
Or no. No, I'm not J.K. Rowling. You know, seven years part of a book that she knew all along what was going to happen. No, I don't know. I know what the ending would be, but I don't know when I'm going to get there. But I know what it will be. I gotta get there, and I don't know if I'm gonna get there at 10 books or 15 books or 7 books. I mean, I don't know.
I'm trying to figure out whether you really are really organized or you're it's hard to tell because you obviously know what you're doing and you're in the moment for every book, and that's important.
I'm definitely in between. I'm not Jeffrey Deaver, you know, who I hear will write an 80-page outline. That's just not me. But at the same time, I don't just write completely seat of the pants. I usually get to a point where I have a pretty good idea how a book's going to start, a pretty good idea how I think it's going to end, and then I just sort of start going. And then, you know, obviously things change along the way. But, you know, I think it's one of those things that you have to learn what's your style, what works for you.
Here's an interesting question. What author do you think writes similar to the way you write? Have you read any other writers that where you say, oh, this is similar to my, I mean, I could use this as, and say, if you like this guy, read me.
No, I can't. I mean, I think it comes down more to genre. If you like mysteries, then you should read these people. If you like, you know what I mean?
Right.
I've never really picked up a book and said, "Gee, I write just like this person."
I don't mean you're copying them or anything. I'm just saying similar.
No, I understand.
The ways that you're
absolutely.
Because I always, when I like an author, I always go online and I look up to see, and I think there's a site actually where you can go on and they'll tell you, if you like so-and-so, try this person. Because a lot of people say that. People will come into the bookstore. When I worked at the bookstore, they'll come in and they'll say, I like this author. Tell me somebody that writes like them that I'm going to enjoy as much as I enjoy this author. And that's what I'm getting at. If you thought there was anybody like that. I've never asked an author that before. And I just thought it would be interesting to ask you to see what you would say. That's half the fun of being an interviewer. You never know what the author's going to say at any given moment.
Yeah, no, very true.
They could say, well, that's a rude question or something, you know. Or I've had authors say to me, well, that's a good question. I don't know how to answer that question. But at least they're honest about it, you know?
Yeah, true.
You got to like the honesty about it. I mean, I cannot wait to read The Trap Girl. I mean, literally sitting here, I'm wishing I had it in front of me and I could start reading it because I know it's going to be good. Because I trust you.
Well, thanks again. I mean, I appreciate it, but I think that's the commitment, like you talked about. I mean, that's the commitment that any artist makes with, you know, the public is you're putting something out there that you believe in and that they're going to spend money on, and they're going to feel like it was worth the amount of money they spent.
Exactly, and as far as I'm concerned, I'm always going to get a good book by you, and I can't imagine you writing a bad book. Can you imagine you writing a bad book?
I can imagine myself writing a bad book. I can't imagine myself
getting
a bad book. Yeah, you know what I mean. I mean, I've written bad books. I mean, I have bad books in my desk drawer. You know, those kind of bad books. You know,
why are they bad books? That's the question.
I don't know. I think it's actually a really interesting main character, but I think I tried. I tried to get kind of woo-woo with it, you know, the supernatural. There's some supernatural stuff in there, and I think if I had just made it more human, then I might go back to the book. It opens really, really, really well. I might go back to it, and instead of making it woo-woo, just make it very real.
You know what? One of the scenes in this book in The Clearing that was so wonderful to me is when she goes to visit, goes to the reservation to visit, is it Elan? Is that his name?
Yeah.
Elan and his father. And what happens, I don't want to say too much, but what happens when she gets there is just an amazing scene. And for some reason, I'm thinking about it right now because it left an impact on me. And I thought, What a powerful scene that was. And when you get to a part of a book when there's a really powerful scene, it really, really does something to you when you're reading it. It just makes you feel like, wow, this guy knows what he's doing. This guy knows.
Absolutely. I got that way when I read The Martian. You know, yeah. So much so that I actually had to email the writer and say, what is your background? Are you a chemist? Are you a blah, blah, blah? How did you do this? And, you know, he said a lot of research. Yeah. But again, it's a book that, you know, it moves you on a number of different levels. I mean, none of us have ever been to Mars, right?
Right.
But every single one of us has felt alone.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he did a really good job of capturing, is this guy is alone. And when you watch the movie with Matt Damon, there's a scene where Matt Damon is in the capsule and he's getting ready to take off and to go back up to the ship, and he's crying. I mean, his tears are just flowing out of his eyes. And what you learned after the fact is that the director, which I believe is Ridley Pearson, the director never let him hear his other actors for months. You know, he was filming a lot of those alone scenes alone, and then suddenly he's in this capsule, and he hears their voices coming through his headset. He hears them saying, and it was so emotional for him that he broke down crying. And all of us have been there. Every single one of us has been in that position before, where we needed to hear another voice. We needed to hear somebody say to us, hey, I'm out here, and it's going to be okay. And I think that's what was so appealing about that book.
Right, absolutely. And I remember reading that book, a little bit of it anyway, and just what he goes through to survive. It's just, wow, I would never even have thought to do that. You know, and it's constantly one thing after another. Do you ever question yourself as a writer? Do you ever wake up in the morning and think, I'm really not that good of a writer? Does that ever go through your head?
Oh, all the time. it's a daily occurrence, you know.
But it isn't true. You really do know what you're doing. I'm not just saying that because I'm interviewing. I really know that you know what you're doing because I've read the book.
I love to write, and I've always loved to write. And I think that if you are blessed, if you're blessed to pursue your passion, then you're going to have some success. And I tell my kids that all the time. I always say, when you get out of school, you don't have to be good at everything. You don't have to be good at Spanish and math and chemistry and history. And, you know, you just find that one thing that you really love to do, that you want to, you get up in the morning and you're excited about going and doing it. And I think that if you're blessed, like I've been blessed, to have the opportunity to do that, more times than not, you're going to have some success.
Now, is The Trap Girl different from the other books? I mean, you described a little bit of it.
It's different in that I think.
Is it more powerful?
It's very powerful, but more than that, it's. I think it's one of those books where people are gonna they're not gonna know what hit them. It's a very complex book. It's an investigation that takes a lot of twists, a lot of turns, and it's just there's a lot between the pages, I guess is the best way to put it.
February can't come fast enough for me. I can say that with all honesty, because I know what I have so much faith in you, because I just know you're good. And you know, and like, you know, an author's good. Like a lot of people felt that way about Elmer Leonard. A lot of people feel that way about John Grisham. I like some of John Grisham's work. I wouldn't say I like everything he's ever written, but you know, people have those authors that they really, really look forward to and have trust in.
Yeah, absolutely.
But you can't ever get to the point, like I was saying before, you can't ever get to the point where your name is the everything and the story doesn't matter anymore. It can't ever get that way, or I won't read you anymore. That's how I feel.
Right, and that goes back to that commitment you make to the reader.
I've never really talked about that before, about that part of it, the aspect of it, but it's so important to me, and I'm sure it's important to a lot of readers.
Oh, absolutely.
But there are times when you just pick up a book and you want to sit and enjoy it, and maybe you don't want to think too much about it, but like watching a comedy on TV, you know, you just want to sit and laugh at dumb humor or something.
Yeah.
Well, it's been so, I don't even know what to say. It's been so great to talk to you, Bob. And this book is really that good, In the Clearing. It's all at all your bookstores and Thomas and Mercer and Amazon and all over, and getting reviewed everywhere. Does PW review it, by the way?
Yeah. Yeah, they gave it a really nice review.
Oh, that's good. How about,
it's gotten really nice reviews all over. A lot of the trade magazines and stuff have given it great reviews. Romance, RW gave it a review, which was great to see, and really liked it a lot. So most of those are up posted on Amazon.
You're off to London now?
I'm off to London. I'm heading over to London and Ireland, and when I get back, then I'll get it figured out what I'm doing on the next one.
Are you happy in your life now?
Love it. Yeah, I love my life. I mean, I have the same glitches that everybody has in their life, I'd say that's 5% of the, that's 5% of the equation. You know, I have a father-in-law that's a pretty wise guy, and he said, you know, if it's 95% of your life is good, you don't fret over the 5% that's not. And so, you know, but like all people, you know, I get up in the morning and I have, you know, things that are different, things that you got to take care of, you know, get the dogs out, walk the dog eats the couch, you know, that's all frustrating, but, you know, the more important things, you know, I want to make sure my kids are okay, that they're doing well in school, that they have opportunity and options to pursue their dreams and their passions, and, you know, I had a medical issue last February that was, you know, serious, and, you know, that opened some eyes for me. You know, I threw a 50th birthday party for my wife. We had 100 people there, and it was great.
Wow.
And wonderful, and everything was going terrific. And as the party was concluding, and I had a stroke.
Wow, I didn't know that.
I had a stroke. And, you know, it's one of those things that sort of opened your eyes to what's important to you and what really matters.
Are you okay now?
I'm fully recovered.
Really?
No issues. You know, people ask me all the time, you know, what do you want? And I always say the same thing. I don't want anything. There's nothing I want for me. I want to grow old with my wife. I want to walk my daughter down the aisle. And I want to see my son graduate happy. Other than that, you know, the rest of the stuff is completely and totally irrelevant to me. I don't care what TV I watch. I don't care about any of that stuff.
Well, you're important to us because you write really well, and we love to read your writing. That's important to us.
Yeah, I love to write. I love to get it out there. But you know, so you have those moments in life, and you know, it's hard not to feel sorry for yourself, or you know. But then you know, you just get out in the world, and I get emails from these people that are dying of cancer, and you know that their prognosis is not great. You know, I have a good friend that he and I are, he's a Cavs fan, and I'm a Warriors fan because I'm from the Bay Area, though I don't really pay much attention to pro basketball. But, you know, he's a Cavs fan, and we've been having a lot of fun over the last couple of days, you know, on Facebook and things like that. But, you know, you can't lose sight of what's really important. You know, I don't really care who ends up winning. I'd love to see the Warriors win, but if the Cavs win, what a great blessing for this man who's dying of cancer.
Yeah.
You know, what a great blessing for him. He, you know, he gets up and he has horrible days, just terribly horrible days.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Going through chemo and all those things. And so, you know, I think I try to just focus on what I have and how blessed I am, and I try not to put too much emphasis on the other things. It's just not worth it.
That's important. I mean, that's really important. A lot of people could learn a lesson from that. It just because we tend to be very selfish people sometimes.
Absolutely.
I know I can. I know I can be selfish, and
yeah,
I know
and I am too.
And
but you know, you get an email like that, and it makes you stop and realize
yes.
How truly lucky you are.
Indeed, and how doing what you love to do is important. It's important
right.
for your well-being. It's important for your life. It's important. I mean, your wife must. She benefits from the fact that you're happy doing what you want to do. You're not doing something that's a drudgery. You're going to get up and say, "Oh, do I have to write again today?"
Yeah. No. Absolutely. You know. And you know, she's my rock. I mean, she's my rock. She's the person that, you know, that I depend most on. And so, yeah, on those bad days, she's gonna be the one that has to deal with it. And you know, I'm like everybody else. I'm moody. I have all those other issues that, you know, but like I said, I think when I look back and I look at my life and I look at what I'm doing, and I see people out there that, you know, are suffering, it's not hard to realize how blessed I am.
I can't imagine what it was like to go through that stroke, what that felt like. I mean,
well, it was really scary. I mean, obviously, because this is what I do for a living, you know, and I actually had to have my wife read a portion of my book before I turned it in, because I didn't know if it didn't make any sense at all,
right,
or, you know what, and, you know, that's frightening. It's frightening to think that, you know, you could lose the thing that you know, provides you the most enjoyment.
Well, you certainly haven't lost it, that's for sure, and I'll know much more when I read The Trap Girl.
Yeah, but, you know, I think it's important to keep everything in perspective.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
In our lives and not take ourselves too seriously. And, you know, I don't take my kids' sporting events as seriously as I used to, because, you know, you realize that there are means to an end. So all is good. I'm happy, I'm healthy, and all is good.
Wow, I don't know what to say. I'm so thrown by what you. I didn't expect you to go into that news. It's a wonderful.
Well, you know, and the thing is, I don't try to hide it. I've done keynotes at things, and I talk about it, and I talk about it because invariably there'll be five or six people in the audience that'll come up to me and say, "I also had a stroke."
Right.
I also had a stroke.
So you get them opening it up about it too, and that's important to open up about.
Or just so other people out there. They'll say, "What happened?" And you can go and talk to them. I mean, it's no different than getting a yearly physical that became embedded in me through a group of men that I used to go, you know, every Friday, and we'd all sit down and talk, and we'd all get together. And one of the things that was really important to all of us was, you know, did you get your yearly physical? Right? Go in and get your physical. You owe that to your family, right? Is there anything? Make sure there's nothing wrong with you. Everything's going to be okay. They're going to catch it in time.
Right.
And it's the same thing that people come up to, and they say, "Well, can I ask what happened?" And I'll say, "Absolutely," and I explain it to them. And then when they, you know, they go in and they see somebody, they, you know what I mean? I just think it's important that when you talk about it, then people can do something about it. And if you don't talk about it, then, you know, people tend to be, you know, like the rest of us, tend to be more, you know, more cautious, more reserved. And I think it's important to get out and talk to it. You know, I have so much respect for Muhammad Ali and Michael J. Fox.
Absolutely.
You know, two people with Parkinson's.
Your heart goes out to them. What they go through.
They're not hiding it. They're out there and they're saying, "This is what it does to you. This is how, you know, this is what's out there that can help, and this is what you got to do." And, you know, God love them for doing it.
Absolutely. Well, this is quite an enlightening interview, even more so than I expected. So it's been wonderful. Let's just mention the book one more time, In the Clearing, all available in all your bookstores now. Get it on Amazon, and I hope you read it because you'll all love it. And this has been David's Book Talk, and we'll talk to you next time.
You have just enjoyed the podcast of David's Book Talk, brought to you by your host, book lover David English. Please visit us at davidsbooktalk.com. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and subscribe to our podcast. We want to hear from you, and we don't want you to miss our upcoming shows with top authors like Mary Higgins Clark, Patricia Cornwell, Lisa Scottolini, Jackie Collins, Nelson DeMille, Michael Connelly, Sue Grafton, Steve Martini, Dale Brown, David Baldacci.